there we go.
Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
GQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
You know, I've got to get a new doorman here at Madame Perry's Salon. Good evening and welcome, everyone. I'm Jennifer, Madame Perry, your host and cruise director for the evening. Madame Perry's Salon, most of you know, began several years ago as a blog, and I called it Salon because I wanted to have different types of people, authors, artists, musicians. I also wanted to echo the feeling of a cultural literary salon of Europe, the UK, Asia, and centuries past. And now it's a podcast where I can have that nice literary, artsy, cool, conversational tone with all the fantastic people that I am fortunate enough to know, because, you know, Madame Perry knows a lot of people. Tonight, I am thrilled to have as a guest an author. Well, I don't know where to begin. I have it listed here as a native New Yorker and author of gritty crime thrillers, Charlie Stella. And let me welcome also my co-host, author Sherry Meeks. Welcome, Charlie and Sherry.
Hey, it's great. Great to be here.
Thank you, Jennifer. Great to be here for me, too. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Say, Charlie, is that your real accent, or do you just use that for your book promotion?
No, this is my real accent. This is the way I talk. I might usually sprinkle it with a couple of choice words, but I'll be a good boy tonight.
Well, I went ahead and you might have noted that I went announced that you might be reading, so I went ahead and went back in the studio and rated it R for language, you know. So
Good.
So don't let us down, okay?
I'll be there.
All right, good. I got no doubt. Charlie, you've got such an impressive body of work that I've got to say, your colleague, because Sherry Meeks and you, well, you're not strangers, are you? You've known one another for quite a while.
Yeah, going back to the MFA program, sure.
Yeah, so how did you, tell us how you met?
Well, I think Sherry was a semester or a year ahead of me, and when I went to the Southern New Hampshire University MFA program, I wanted to do that for a long time. I wanted to get an MFA for a while, more just for the experience of it, and I met Sherry up there. I immediately nicknamed it the Georgia Peach, and it's been a beautiful thing, yeah.
Yeah, and it was so, I mean, I think it was about, I was a year ahead of you, Charlie. But Charlie was so gracious. I mean, he's a great. I mean, Charlie's a great guy. You can hear by talking to him what a great guy he is. And he's just, he was nice enough to read my book, Jennifer, and I really appreciate that, Charlie. So, but it was a fun experience.
Now, do you know for a fact if he's stolen anything from it or not?
Charlie? Well, if he did, I'd just let him have it.
Well, now listen. No, nothing and no one is safe around a writer. You know that, right? I mean, everything gets stolen. Everything gets, you know, reworded. So, yeah, absolutely.
That's so true. Yeah.
Okay. And so the
original ideas are there, you know.
So I had to make sure everybody knew how you two met, so that way, if you get into some little personal jabs and everything, I don't want everybody going thinking we got a secret language. What, you do have a secret language with your friends. But, so anyway, Charlie, you've got quite an impressive body of work, and I'm not just talking about your powerlifting either, but I'm talking about, let's start with your books. You know, even if you just read the titles, you got an idea of where you're going here. Johnny Porno, Jimmy Bench Press, Charlie Opera.
Yeah, a little bit of what I try to do with every title is just give kind of a clue of, you know, mm-hmm. about the protagonist and where this thing is heading. So I'm an opera lover. That's why I was Charlie Opera. That's my email address, actually. I'm an opera lover. I fell in love with it a while back when I took my kids to growing up with opera. And, you know, any title, it kind of reflects exactly what's going on in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the last one I did, which was about James Giuliani, the Dogma book, which came through the MFA program, actually. And that's a book about a guy. It's a bio about a guy who was an enforcer. I mean, it's nonfiction. It's a true story. But he was an enforcer for the Gambinos, and his life got turned around when he saw this dog on the street. And, you know, it was an abandoned dog. It was really banged up. And the guy's now spent the rest of his life, you know, 24/7, literally, taking care of dogs and rescuing dogs, which is pretty cool.
Wow.
That really is. And that song in the book is Dogfella?
Yeah, yeah.
Dogfella, how an abandoned dog named Bruno turned this mobster's life around. And that was published earlier this year in May, right?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, that is literally a true story. That's you know, that's pretty impressive stuff. You know, as writing it was pretty easy because James and I kind of have the same background, you know, street background. So in fact, that's how I got the project. Was the agent James? One of James's agents was at one of the readings at MFA up in Southern New Hampshire when we graduated. And he heard my ability to curse on paper and just, you know, that street dialogue stuff. And they said, well, you know, let me give this guy a shot. So apparently they went through a few writers and you know, none of them came up with the right voice. But I was real familiar with James's voice. And I spent a lot of time with James going over the stuff, you know, and going over the story. And, you know, we spent quite a bit of time together. And that's how the book came about, really.
All right. I like
you're
that.
Talking about- I do too.
Go ahead, Sherry.
And you know, you were talking about voice, Charlie, and I've read Cheapskate. And the voice, it's so authentic. It's, you know, caustic, most of your people. And the dialogue, how do you come up with the dialogue that you come up with? I mean, I'm guessing it's from living that life, Charlie.
Well, you know, it's really weird because for a long time I tried to write. I mean, I, you know, going back to when I was in my 20s, early 20s, or even before that, I basically got into this stuff because I wasn't a reader. I wasn't a student at all, any way, shape, or form. I was, you know, just a dopey jock trying to, you know, make believe I knew what I was doing. And a teacher of mine in North Dakota, Minot, North Dakota, was a small school I attended. He read the opening lines to Friends of Eddie Coyle, which I still insist is the greatest crime novel ever written. It's a short mm-hmm. book, but it's incredible. And it's all dialogue-driven. He was the master, original master of dialogue. I could recite most of that book. That's how many times I've read
wow.
it. And I heard him read that opening line, and I was like, holy shit, I could do that. You know, not to be as good as Higgins, but Jesus, that's the way, you know, everybody I know talks like that. So I said, let me give it a shot. And he was just so encouraging all through my life, you know, until I got published. You know, he's always there. Like, I would send him stuff, you know, I'd probably berate him, you know, just barrage him with crap I was writing. And no matter how bad it was, he kind of encouraged me to keep trying. And eventually I got lucky, you know, really.
And not only that, Charlie, you do the same thing, too. Part of what you do is you encourage and motivate and try to help
oh, absolutely.
New writers. You
absolutely. It's the hardest thing for writers is to get over themselves, you know, is to get over the fear. Get over the fear of being
mm-hmm.
rejected, the fear of all that crap, and it just my belief. I mean, it's kind of part of my, you know, redemption in life, is to just encourage people to do it. I mean, it's why I did the MFA program. A lot of people shit on MFA programs. They just, you know, it's all crap. It's a way for college to make money and all that crap. It's, you know, yeah, if you go in assuming you're going to come out with a bestseller, that's not a great idea. That's not a good thing to pursue. But if you're a writer, if you really want to, you know, just increase your craft, your ability, you know, get your, you know, hone your skill, there's no better thing in the world to do. You know, and it's, you know, for the dollars, yeah, they're all expensive. But you know, you can throw away a lot more on a car, you know, so.
That's very true. That's a good way to look at it, Charlie.
And oh, yeah, I mean, every car costs $40,000 now, so.
Exactly. Exactly. So you definitely feel that you learned something by going through the MFA program, even though you were a published author before that.
Yeah, I went in with 8 books published and a ton of short stories, a screenplay and everything. But the reality is that, you know, as much as I love it, it's kind of screwed me up with crime writing because I used to write a book a year, and now I've taken like 2, 3, 4 years sometimes. I basically have like 4 or 5 projects going at one time, and when I get bored with one, I hop to another. I started writing a play the other night, and that was my first love was playwriting, was drama. And as much as I love the program, and it was really priceless for me because just the reading list that they provided, it just got me turned on as a reader to no end. As much as I love it, though, it's really kind of blocked my crime fiction because I'm constantly jumping around with different projects. But it's still worth it. It's still worth it. I'd do it again if it was cheap enough.
So you had how many books before you went in the MFA program, Charlie?
I think I was up to 8, and I had 9. And number 9 was in the queue, or it was 7, and number 8 was in the queue. I have no idea how many books. I think it's 8 or 9 books. But I got another one coming out next spring, finally. I got my act together and finished the book I had started 3 years ago. I actually started it and part of the MFA program. Remember that dopey island we used to be on, Sherry?
What
was it?
Shutter Island,
yeah.
We
used to go to this retreat there. It was like going to prison. It was, you know. But I used that in the book. That there's a big part of Star Island in that book. There's a hit that takes place on Star Island. So that's the next book. It's called Tommy
Red.
Oh, now
I've really got to read it, Charlie. I've really got to read it now. That's pretty cool.
Sounds like it might bring back a lot of memories for you, Sherry.
Exactly.
But you've had a lot of short stories published as well, haven't you?
Yeah. I'm in quite a few anthologies, and I still write short stories from time to time. I wanted to do a project with Dana King, who's a terrific, terrific writer. I think about 2 or 3 years ago, I said, you know, let's do a book of short stories together. You do one, I'll do one. You know, we'll go back and forth, and I think I started it, and Dana probably wrote 15 of them already. And like I said, since this program, the MFA program, I jump around like a maniac. I mean, I start a literary story, I wind up back in a crime story, I wind up writing a screenplay, I wind up writing a stage play. So, you know, I'm sure he did his job. I'm the guy who's behind.
Well, I have a feeling at some point, Charlie, though, you're going to have like 10 pieces of work that are finished all at one time, even though you're jumping around.
I hope so. I mean, I got a lot of stuff on the plate, but, I finished a couple of them. I'm just not happy with them yet. I finished 2 or 3 books, and I'm just not happy with them yet. So, you know, that's the thing you learn over time is patience as a writer. You realize that, you know, the first thing you write so hard. My daughter right now and her husband, my son-in-law, are writing a terrific screenplay. And they've been doing it. You know, this is their second draft. But I could sense the impatience, you know. So we're going to workshop it this weekend, actually. And I could just see, like, you know, when you write something, a piece, and Sherry, you'll know what I'm talking about. You write a chapter, and you get 10 chapters down the book, and you want to go back to the beginning, and you just love this one piece so much, even if it doesn't fit anymore. And you know, you got to fight yourself not to, you know, to get rid of it. And I think they're going through that little experience now. But it's a terrific screenplay. I can't wait for them to get done with it.
Have they named it yet, Charlie? Have they named the screenplay yet? Or is it too soon?
You know,
they
changed it twice. They've changed the name twice. And it's a psychological thriller. It's a terrific idea. I mean, I love the idea. And there's some great stuff in it. And, you know, we're just going through the pains of getting it finished, you know.
Gotcha.
It's that first writer syndrome where, you know, the first time they get to, and my daughter's been writing for a while, she's just so damn shy. I wish she would go into a program because she's got so much damn talent. All 3 of my kids are terrific writers. Let me say that right up front. And they're way ahead of where I was at their age. I mean, I wasn't anywhere near that. I was being a dopey street guy at their age. So
I bet they're very proud of your books, though, aren't they? Your work.
Yeah, you know, they're very encouraging, I'll tell you that. I mean, you know, you go back, I mean, I started off, I was when I came out of college, I got married very young. I was a window cleaner for 10 years. Then I taught myself word processing, stuff like that. And I used to tell them, one day I'm going to get published. And the one thing I tried to instill in my kids is never, ever give up a dream. It's just the dumbest thing to do. You know, there's that old dopey commercial. It's not a dopey commercial, but it's an old commercial that used to say, you know, time, mind is a terrible thing to waste. Talent is a terrible thing to waste, just equally, you know. And you just got to pursue things you believe in. You know, you just have to. You can't let people talk you out of it. And my father was very pragmatic, so it was about making money. So, you know, it took a while for me to get over the hump. But I have good people encouraging me.
We're very glad you did. I know that Akashic Books has a series of noir anthologies. I know my friend Kevin Guilfoyle was in the one Chicago Noir. And Baltimore Noir features a story by you called Ode to the O's.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the next book is a character from that book, from that short story, Tommy Red. He's a character in the short story I did, Ode to the O's. That's about 1969 was a horror story for Baltimore. Because the Jets beat the Colts, the Mets beat the Orioles, and the Knicks knocked the Bullets off real early. So that was kind of a theme on it had to do with Baltimore, and I had never been to Baltimore in my life before that. So the editor of the book, Laura Lipman, my best-selling author, she's phenomenal. You know, her husband is the producer of The Wire, Tremé, and I mean a whole bunch of HBO stuff. You know, really good stuff.
And so, Laura Lipman, she contributed as well as edited this book. And did she work with you a lot on editing, or did you?
Well, actually, the only reason I got into that book is I guess she ran into a problem, and she had sent me an email. They needed a couple more stories, and she sent me an email. Can you put something together? And I put it together fairly quickly, about a couple of weeks, and and it worked out. Then we went down for the reading. It was the first time I ever went to Baltimore in my life. I went down for they had this panel with a lot of the authors that had contributed. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. But I knew that I had a novel in the middle of that story somewhere with this guy Tommy Red. I just love his way of speaking, which is to repeat things over and over. So, like, she says to me, she says, and I kind of kid around with that once in a while with my mother and drive her crazy when I do my Mama Stella stuff, yeah.
Yes, I've heard some reference to this Mama Stella, but I don't know if I've.
And every once in a while, I'll do something on Facebook. I'll have a conversation with my mother that is like off the wall, and I go there a couple times a week, three times a week, just to keep her heart beating. I break her shoes. I get her this curse at me, then I know I won.
He posted something about his mom trying to explain a podcast to his mom. But I'm sure that was tough, Charlie.
Oh, yeah, forget about it. She has no idea.
What does she say? She thinks it's something you invented, like maybe you're into sci-fi stories now or something, or that podcast is a new way of getting rid of, you know, somebody from another gang? It's an enforcer technique or something,
just,
or MO?
Nah, she
yeah,
just,
we're
going to
podcast
just
him
follow.
Into the East River. Okay.
Yeah, she doesn't follow very well on that kind of stuff. She's not too technologically savvy. Not that I am. Believe me, I'm not either. But I just have fun with her. She's great. And all toughness comes from Mama Stella, believe me. She's a lot tougher than I'll ever be.
Tommy Red, we are looking to have Tommy Red in our hot little hands by spring of next year, aren't we?
Yeah. It's already done. It's been sold. I just have to, you know, one more cleanup of it, and I think it'll go to galley probably around January, something like that. And that's with Stockhouse Press, and these guys are great. Greg Shepard is just a great guy. He's the publisher there. And I work with Rick Olman and Merle Drown. You know, Sherry, you know Merle. Merle edits my crime novels now. Yeah, he's my editor on crime novels. And it's great. It's just a great.
Yeah. Merle was an instructor at Southern New Hampshire.
Yes. And he's an author. He's a great author. I mean,
he is a great author. That's right. He is an author as well. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just to get to know a little bit more about you, too, and some of your habit, shall we say. Now, you said you enjoy reading new writers. What new writers have you read lately that you find pretty interesting that you would recommend to people?
Oh, man. Just about everybody in that program. I mean, Darren Rome, incredible book he wrote. In fact, I think he had two offers to have it published, and he went with my publisher, Greg Stockhouse, The Trees Beneath Us. It's an incredible book. Kelly Stone Gamble, They Call Me Crazy, that was a book a couple of years ago. I read 2 or 3 years ago, which was that year was probably one of the best books I read that year, and that includes everything, classics and everything else. Darren's book is just off the charts great also. And now there's a couple of people coming out of there that have getting starred reviews up the gazoo. Pratima Krantz's book, All the Major Consolations, got a Publishers Weekly and a Kirkus starred review. That's pretty hard to do. And one of the mentors, my last semester's mentor, Diane Lebeck, she was the rector of the thing, she just got 3-star reviews in a row. I mean, this stuff is, that's pretty highfalutin stuff. That's big stuff.
Oh,
there's
indeed,
no small potatoes there.
Yep, and it shows that MSA programs are worth their salt for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, people could shit on them all they want. If you're a serious writer and you need that little push, or you want that extra push, or you want to pick up stuff, you got to be a fool not to do it. You know.
Did you always read as a kid? I mean, were you always a big reader?
Yeah, all I ever read as a kid was sports biographies, you know, Willie Mays story, the Daily News I'd read about the Mets every day. And, you know, as I got older, the racing form, very important, things like that. But once I got to college, you know, well, actually, before I stop myself here a second. In high school, one of the first real interests I got into literature was Miss Miller. I wish I could find her. I think it was my junior year or senior year, she introduced me to Camus, The Stranger. And that first line of that book has never left me, and it haunts me. And I started reading, you know, fairly decently about that time. And then I put it off for all the other stupid things I did in my life. And every once in a while, I'd read 4 or 5 books in a month and, you know, then put it away for 6 months. By the time I got published, I was reading a book a week, sometimes 2 books a week. Now, just this last couple of months, because I'm doing so much other work, I've kind of slowed down on my reading. I'm reading maybe 4 books a month. I used to read, you know, seriously, a book a week, 2 books a week. I used to walk around my building at work. I still, well, now I broke my toe, so I can't do it. But I used to walk around the building and work in the morning and at lunch and just read. I take a book everywhere. If I go to the gym, I don't deal with the muscle heads. I just sit there and I read in between my sets. I bring a book everywhere. So now as a kid, but now I read, you know, religiously.
Yeah, I think you said something to me about keep one in case you're, you know, in line somewhere or had to wait on AAA or whatever. Because that's one thing my husband and I always have, you know, several books we're reading. We always have something with us in case. We have a little extra time. So some people say, oh, well, I've got all this time. We're like, okay, good, we can read now.
I was reading my daughter's screenplay in the doctor's office yesterday. I pinched a nerve in my neck last week, and I had to take off. Getting old sucks. But, I wound up going to the doctor finally, and I just brought my daughter's screenplay there and finished reading it, making notes for her, you know, because, like I said, we're going to workshop it this week. But I can't imagine going anywhere without a book.
Exactly.
It's just, you know, I hate wasting time. There's nothing that drives me crazy than wasting time. So sitting in traffic, they could give me 6 tickets a day. I come home from work, I cut into the right lane, onto the grass, anything to get home, you know, so.
To read or write when you get home.
Well, usually the first thing I do when I come in is light my pipe and smoke for about an hour straight. Then I sit down and edit whatever I did during the day. At work, I'm a word processor, so the beauty of that job is, you know, at lunchtime, I always get to work 45 minutes early, and I work on whatever I worked on the night before I edit it, and then at lunchtime, I go over it again. And if there's downtime, you know, and there's nothing going on, I'll take a peek at whatever the hell I'm doing. I'm writing at the time, and, you know, and today I found out, because I was thinking about what I was going to read tonight. I'm looking at Tommy Redd. I said, oh, let me do Tommy Redd. You're not going to believe this. What I did was I password protected the stupid document, and of course I can't remember the password.
Oh,
so, you believe it?
Maybe.
Yeah,
I'm
a mess.
Maybe it's
Charlie, you're a tease.
No, you have no idea. At work, the poor IT guys, every month they got to come in and reset my password because I can't remember it over the weekend. And I usually make it the same thing. I mean, I'm a mess. You have no idea. I got shit scribbled all over the place to try to remember it, and who knows which one is which, you know.
Well, but that's not all you do. You have other things. I said, so you're a power lifter. You train.
Absolutely.
No, you know what? I kid myself with that crap. The last power meet I was in was like 2009, maybe 2011. But what I do is I go into these training cycles, and inevitably before I get to week 12, which is the cycle ends, and you know usually set it up for a meet like the following week. I was planning on going to one on the 7th, November 7th in Philadelphia, and you know broke my toe like a week before that. My dog kept me up all night, and I got pissed off, and I started walking real fast. I said, let me go down and work. It was like 2:30 in the morning. You know, when I can't sleep, I'll just come down and write. And I walked right into a radiator. So powerlifting is I just play with myself. That's nothing real. Those days are over. But
How much do you lift, Charlie? How much do you lift?
Well, I can lift myself, which is a lot. I don't get into the weights anymore. I'm a heavy guy. I lost 91 pounds last year. I found 50 before I knew what the hell happened. So.
But you still, Charlie, that's 41 still gone. So that's good.
I know. I still got 41 to go. That's what I said. I got to break my own record. But it's easier putting it on. It's a lot more fun, too.
Oh, it's a lot more fun. You know, it's like I remember my mother saying, you know, the older I get, the more I like my own cooking. And now I understand what she means, you know. So it's like, I got to be careful.
Oh, yeah.
Got to be careful.
Well, it's my wife's fault. My wife cooks for an army, so it's her fault.
Well, you say your wife, how does she feel about all this powerlifting training that you do?
She hates it. One meet she comes to, she goes to, was about 2010 or 11, I don't know, one of those years. I was the New Jersey Open, and I was in pretty good lifting shape at the time. Right before I got a lift, before my division lifts, which was the super heavyweights, the fat guys, some poor kid, I don't know how he did it, but he dropped the weight on his neck. And, the whole place. I didn't even see it. My wife saw it, and she freaked out, you know. And she just assumed. Now, honestly, you got to be an idiot to do that, because there's a way to hold the bar where that can't happen.
Yeah.
So I don't know how he did it, but he managed to do it. He survived, but, you know, it was a big scare. The whole place, you know, they had a heart attack.
Wow, God, maybe he wasn't focusing or something. I don't know.
I think he didn't have his hands wrapped around the bar. I think some kids, when they lift, they do it wrong, and they'll lift with it, and they'll curl their fingers in, and they'll rest the bar in a groove, and it's dumb. I mean, it's just dumb.
Yeah. I haven't done that very much, but I started cross-train workout. I was doing 6 days a week, so then my husband was like, yeah, it's my he-man of a wife. Why don't you go out there and move some logs, you know, split some logs or something. No.
Well, that cross training is serious.
No,
stuff.
But I'll
that's,
open that.
That's hard.
I'll open that pickle jar. Yeah. Okay.
Well, Charlie, speaking of your wife, this wife is the wife that turned your life around, correct?
Big time.
The wife?
Yeah. Very much the way James Giuliani described his Madeline, Madalena turned his life around. My wife did with me because I was. Let's see, I met Annie. I was still doing the street stuff, and I wrote the book, my first book, to impress her. And I got lucky, it got published, and then I walked away from a lot of money. And about 2 years later, a lot of the people I used to hang out with took a big pinch. So, and she really did. And I was lucky. I've been lucky all my life. I can't complain about anything. And, she's been everything, you know, just everything. And she's my first editor, and she's a great editor.
Is she?
I didn't know that. I didn't know she was.
Oh, she rips my stuff to pieces. Oh, my God. She just a book I worked on for about 6 years called Liebestod, which is it's an aria from a Wagner opera, Tristan and Isolde. And I wrote this, and I thought it was brilliant. I swore it was brilliant. And she ripped it to shreds. She says, you've got two different books here. So she says, now you got an extra project. Yeah, she's great. She's great.
So she does not hold back.
She doesn't. When she first edited my stuff, she used to be afraid because I go, oh, what do you know? You know, what do you know about the street? And she would actually get so upset she'd cry. Now, I don't even, you know, I just, 80-90% of what she tells me, I just don't even argue. I just do it.
Because she does know what she's talking about.
Oh, she's a reader. She's a smart cookie. She's way smarter than I am.
How did you meet Annie?
At work. I was working midnights in a law firm, word processing, at night. And during the day, I was a loan shark and a bookmaker. And at that point, I was just running a sheet, actually. I didn't have my own office. But she was going to school. She's, you know, raising a kid, going to school, and working a split shift. And the truth is, there's that love at first sight stuff. That's not bullshit. That happened. And in fact, I was at a party with her and her sister. Her sister worked on the same shift as me. And I was invited, so I brought my son, my youngest son, Dustin. And as soon as I didn't formally introduce him yet. I did formally introduce him, and then we're waiting online to get a drink, and I said to Dustin, "So what do you think of your next stepmother?" Because I was still married at the time.
Oh. How long have y'all been married now? How long have y'all been married, Charlie?
We're together 14 years, married 13. I'm her third husband, so she's just as bad as I am, and she's my fourth wife. But we're very solid. We're going
to
ride.
You're meant to be together. You're meant to be together, Charlie.
Yeah.
That is great.
I like that. Now, did she I thought you would say that she came to see you playing in a club. You're a musician, right?
I play drums, but no. She's very encouraging about the drums. But we met literally on the job, and she couldn't put up with the street stuff for a second. So that was good. That was a deal breaker if I had stayed on the street. So, once I got published, I was out of that, and we hooked up right away, and it was over. You know, my street life was over, and I just focused on being a legitimate businessman, being a legitimate worker, which, let me tell you, my first 2 years of that was an adjustment, mentally and financially. That was an adjustment. I used to walk around with a grand in my pocket all the time in case somebody needed money or whatever. But that's, forget those days are over. Now I walk around with $2 in my wallet, so.
But you're much happier, aren't you, Charlene? I'm sure you are.
Honestly, yeah. There's no comparison. I'm doing exactly what I wanted to do my whole life, so I can't complain.
Do you ever consider writing, a nonfiction book about your life? Do you ever consider writing
MFA,
a memoir?
Well, my MFA thesis was a second-person attempt of writing somewhat of a biography. It's a memoir, but it's a fictional memoir because I throw the Holy Ghost in it. If you ever see the movie Dogma?
Yeah,
it's a very funny movie. And and my issues with religion, so I basically took this opportunity to write it's kind of a prosecution of me, of my life, and an attempt at redemption. And I go through a lot of what my life was, but I fictionalize it with, I bring in the Holy Ghost, I bring in the saints, I bring in Alanis Morissette as God, Alan Rickman is the Holy Ghost, and they're actually part of it. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to do. But again, I'm still not happy with it. It's done, but my wife is actually going to tear it up now, so she's actually got the almost 400 pages of it. So.
Wow. Well, the fact, too, that that is in second person. How tough is that?
Honestly, I could never write about myself, even whether I was writing plays or anything. I cannot write first person with a gun to my head. So what I did was I read was an assignment from one of the mentors in the program to read Bright Lights, Big City, which is second person.
Right.
And I read that and I said, holy shit, this is the way to go. I mean, I'm telling you, I tried this a number of times first person and could never do it. So I saw Red Bright Lights, Big City. Let me try it this way. And it just came out. It spilled out. So, a lot of rewrites, but it spilled out. It really did. Okay. And I had a lot of help with the mentors. They were great. I mean, really great. Diane actually was at the end. And Rick Carey, I mean, they were great. They were really great. Really helped me out.
They are.
That's are you going to actually read to us tonight, Charlie?
Well, I got some of that, some of the thesis here in front of me. It's towards the end. It's the last scene before the end of the book, And I can if you want. Tell me how long you want me to go, because it's double space, it's 6 pages and a lot of dialogue.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, that sounds perfect, actually. And so just to give you a little chance to, since we've been, we've had you talking, just give you a little moment of voice rest, I'm going to play a song that hopefully will lead into it. It's called Sex and the Drugs. It's by Elizabeth Elkins.
All right.
All right, so we'll be back. And we are here with Charlie Stella and my co-host, Sherry Meek. We're going to be back with Charlie's going to read from upcoming work, but I've also got all the information here, so you can check out Charlie's blog. You can get all the titles of his books and know where to order them. Right now, I'm reading Charlie Opera, and I swear you've got to get this. You've got to get this book. It's got all these little wonderful little twists in it that just keep you, you know, just when you think you know what's going to happen, it really keeps you on edge. So that's what I love. So Elizabeth Elkins, Sex and the Drugs. And the Drugs. That's from Elizabeth Elkins, and you may have heard a lot of her music. You may know her already. If not, you've probably heard her music on TV shows and movies like Small Town, Mean Girls, and several other films and TV shows. I think she's also on Rescue. Some of her music's also been on Rescue Me, the Dennis Leary show. So we are back. This is Madam Perry, and I'm back with my lovely co-host, Sherry Meeks, and our lovely special guest, Charlie Stella. Hello.
Hey.
Hello.
Still here. Still here.
All right. So, and we think we've got a little special treat that Charlie's going to read to us tonight.
Okay. Now, I'm going to give you a quick backstory. It's called A Ponderous Chain. It was originally called The Second Coming, and it used to have to do with a kid being called Little Jesus by his very overprotective and delusional mother and grandmother. It's an attempt at redemption, more in the form of self-prosecution. It deals with some reality and a lot of fiction, so it isn't a biographical memoir per se. It is fictional memoir with appearance of saints, Holy Ghost, God herself. If you saw the movie Dogma, you'll get the Alan Rickman and Morissette references. Alanis Morissette. Anyway, this is from part four, currently the next last chapter. Okay, it's second person, so bear with me. The title of this scene is Il Sogno di Dio, In the Presence of the Lord, Part 2. Way back when you first started cleaning windows for a living, you stepped out on a ledge at 10 East 53rd Street to clean a corner office's French windows. You were the proverbial dumbass worker putting his job ahead of his life. In time, you would learn such risks were nothing more than stupid. But that morning, about 4:30 a.m. or so, you literally climbed out of a window with a 15-floor drop to a courtyard below. They were windows you'd never be able to reach. No one's past should ever be dismissed in its entirety, not according to the justice you want to believe in. Sooner or later, everybody has to pay. You've been guilty of way too much over the course of your life to be granted unfettered absolution, and finding Anne-Marie at just the right time to keep you from going to jail with a bunch of wannabe mobsters has proved nothing short of a miracle you don't deserve. She's the priest who bought Valjean's soul for God, and you owe the rest of your life to doing the right thing because of her. Because you're guilty of so much you haven't begun to pay for, you do what comes natural and panic about the wave of bad that has to happen to you sooner or later. Mostly it has to do with Anne-Marie and your kids, in a nightmare scenario where one or more of them would be taken from you by some disease or tragedy before you get to die first. So you relentlessly perform your nightly prayer, pleading for whatever bad that has to happen because of what you've been or done, it should happen only to you. And one night, after saying your personal prayer, you dream something that couldn't be more real. A morning when you do slip from the same window ledge at 10 East 53rd, fall into the abyss of that courtyard 15 floors below. It is because the ponderous chain dragged you backwards away from the window ledge, and you couldn't hold on to the frame. The chain rattles as you fall, and then there is a thud, and you can hear it, but can't feel it. The darkness turns to a very bright and blinding light. You swear you've passed into the beyond when a woman in white with long dark hair stands directly above you and smiles. Alanis, you say? The woman in white responds telepathically. The smile never leaves her face. It's okay, she says. Am I dead? I'll put you back. Was it the fall? Just for now. You try to see beyond her, but can't. The brightness is blinding. You're really God, not just in the movie. For now. You begin to sob until it becomes uncontrollable. You kneel at her feet, and she puts a reassuring hand on your head. I have so many questions, you say. It's okay. I don't know what to say, where to begin. I know. I'm sorry. I know. I'm so sorry. I know. For everything. I know. How do I? What can I? It's okay. When? How? It's okay. Was it a test? Our lives? Are they tests? It's okay. Duellen was weiß es bedeutet, you say. You're confused. You could hear yourself as if someone else was speaking. You ask, am I speaking in tongues? Another voice responds, a familiar voice. That was a note Gustav Mahler left on his 10th sympathy to his wife. It's Alan Rickman, the dogma version. It had to do with a combination of things, he says. Her infidelity, his poor health, the funeral march they were observing from their window. It might have been what Mahler believed could be the end of his marriage and his life. You're confused, but you feel a calming hand you can't see on your head. Alanis, you say? A cloud appears, and you can make out your friend, St. Patrick, through the mist. Dago, he says. Potato head, you say. True friends, Alan Rickman says. You weren't kidding, you say to Alan Rickman. That really was God, wasn't it? Alanis, I mean. Or St. Patrick, whichever you prefer, he says. You hold both hands up. Whoa, you say. Now you're really fucking with my head. This potato head? Ignorant wop, St. Patrick says. You smile at his smile. Even Alan Rickman is smiling. I'll do the communicating from here in, he says. St. Patrick is gone. So is Alanis. You turn to Alan Rickman. I can't believe it, you say. Alanis Morissette. To you, he says. To someone else, it could be B.B. King or Mozart, Willie Mays or 50 Cent. Is it really 50 Cent? Alan Rickman nods. Is there a resurrection? Is this it? Eventually. All at once for everyone, each in their own way. To give it a moment's thought. One for 50, Mozart, Willie and the rest of us, all of us? It isn't rocket science, he says. But I fucked up. I fucked up a lot, and with a lot of people, especially with my kid, I fucked up. It can't be that easy. Everyone fucks up, even your kid. It is that easy. No, I meant the redemption, the atonement, the forgiveness. I didn't earn it. I know what you meant, he says. Then how? How can I be forgiven? How can you accept me here? Here isn't here, not yet. You shake your head. Dude, you've got to stop fucking with me. Alan Rickman rolls his eyes, telepathically sending you a message. Do you remember your first report card, little Jesus? Of course you do. Do you remember how you couldn't be held accountable for coveting your neighbor's wife? How it was not applicable until you were in your mid-teens? You close your eyes and can see the report card. But I got an F when I was 14, you say. But it wasn't applicable until you were 14, he says. And even that F was just a feeble attempt for you to check yourself, to keep me from jerking off so I might not go blind. Something like that. You're confused again, and tell Alan Rickman so. Yeah, but I still don't get it. No one is perfect, not even Alanis. Suddenly you're incredulous. What? You heard me, little Jesus. Even if you follow the book of fairy tales, how we refer to the Bible here, you'll notice on more than a few occasions the fallibility of the Creator. Your hands go up. This is so blowing my mind right now. Hang in there, Alan Rickman says, and pay attention. You sigh, then nod, and then shrug. Fine, you say. Go ahead. You've read Dostoevsky, right? Yeah, a few of his books. A few times each, in fact. Redemption through suffering? Yeah, okay, but where's the suffering? You're doing it now, he says. Huh? Your conscience. Think about Raskolnikov. What was his greatest suffering? That was torture. Not so different than what you do to yourself. Except not always, which is why I don't get it. One minute I feel guilty, and the next I do something deserving of guilt. Who doesn't, he says. Who hasn't? I know, but nothing. Remember, the end of a movie you can't get out of your head for two very different reasons. One has to do with a southern accent and racism and the actress wearing a black bra and panties, but the other has to do with a speech at the end of the movie. You struggle to remember, although the image of the actress wearing the black bra and panties is fresh in your head. It can be one of two different movies. You saw the movie, he says. You've seen it more than a few times. You always feel the same way about it at the end. You feel guilty. Then Alan Rickman changes his voice into Morgan Freeman's voice. He said, decency. Decency is what your grandmother taught you. It's in your bones. Now you go home. Go home and be decent people. Be decent. Bonfire of the vanities, you say. And although you can hear Morgan Freeman speaking, you're looking at Melanie Griffin in the black bar and panties, and you immediately feel guilty. See, Alan Rickman says? That's that part.
That was excellent.
That was great. That was fantastic.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for reading to us. Oh God, I have a comment that came in and some questions from a friend of ours, friend of the show, David Hurley. He's an author and a poet, and a publisher of Subtlety Magazine. And he always texts in his messages, questions to me. It says, "Tell Charlie this. You had me at Johnny Porno. I'm looking through the novel titles. I'm looking through the novel titles and synopses, and I'm digging them a lot. I think of crime, gangster, mob literature, and movies as being very much like the Westerns. Would you agree? It's no mistake that Sergio Leone made. I think he's got a couple of questions in here, so I'm going to go ahead and read through. It says, it's no mistake that Sergio Leone made masterpiece Western films and Once Upon a Time in America, which is an elegiac, poetic mob genre masterpiece. What pop culture influences or inspirations besides Dogma, which you mentioned, do you have?
Very early on, and I found this fascinating when I read it about, who's the guy who wrote The Sopranos? Jesus, I can't think of his name. Whoever the guy was, it's driving me nuts, I can't remember his name. I read in a book, a magazine, about his background. When I was a real young kid, there was a movie called Pay or Die with Ernest Borgnine. It was like one of the first mob movies. It was about the Black Hand. And Lieutenant Petrosino, I think, is the guy. And all the years I watched it a million times, I thought it was just, a fictional piece, a movie, movie script. Turns out, I was a loan shark at the time. I lived in Little Italy in New York. And I was standing in front of, I passed this thing 1,000 times, a little triangle piece of property. It's a little park with a fence around it. Must have passed it 1,000 times. And one day I'm waiting for one of my customers to drop off money, and I'm standing in front of that park, and I turn around, and this is actually it's in the thesis, the thing I wrote. I turn around and look at signs that are on the wall there, on the gate. Lieutenant Petrosino Square is the name of the place. You can look it up on Google. I almost freaked out. It was a true story. I never knew it. That's how stupid I am. So there I am, and I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, this is a guy who, because when I watched the movie, of course I looked up to the cop. So here I am, I don't know, 40 years later, or 30 years later, 30-something years later, and I'm the bad guy. And it was just like a real smack in the face that day. It really was. It didn't stop me from doing what I did for another couple of years. And it didn't really stop me. Getting published stopped me. But, I mean, honestly, I'd probably be in jail today if I never got published. And the reality is that that influence, that was a tremendous influence on me. Other influences are writers and musicians. I love all art. I listen to all different kinds of music. I'm an opera freak. I listen to blues music. I like to play blues on the drums, rock, everything. Anything and everything, I would say. Anything and everything. Elmore Leonard is a writer. George V. Higgins, obviously. Mm. You know, just everything. I'm one of those creative types that I can't tie my own shoelaces. I can do nothing. I'm useless in the house. I can't fix anything. My wife fixes everything. All I can do is earn money, pick up heavy things, and write. That's it.
And that's so much more than so many people, you know. Also,
really.
David Hurley also added in, you were looking for the name David Chase.
Oh, that's it, David Chase, exactly, yes. Yeah. He's the guy, and he saw the same movie. That was my point about that whole monologue I went into. David Chase, apparently, when I read this magazine, that was one of his first early influences. I said, holy shit, he got there ahead of me.
All right, so I'm going to have to let you go soon. So before we do, I want you to tell us, we know that there's a book coming out in May. However, mm-hmm. What would you recommend as a first book for somebody who hasn't read Charlie's Teller yet as a book to start with?
Well, all my books kind of intermingle. The characters jump. There's a couple of characters that they go through almost all the books. My favorite is the one you read, is Cheapskates, which has a little bit of truth in it. Every one of my books has a little bit of reality in it, so some of my past. Cheapskates was a fun book to write. Apparently, Johnny Porno's getting all the attention because we sold it to Mexico, Poland, and we're going to Germany next year. It's going to be released there also in the spring. So that's the one that's getting a lot of play. Historically, that's a 1973 novel, and everything else kind of takes place after 2001. But I would say Cheapskates only because I had so much fun with it.
Well, Cheapskates, I've got to mention, with that one, Charlie, the first thing that comes to mind thinking about that book is you must have been around some cold-hearted women. One of the characters in the book is like, wow.
I don't know. I'll say this much about it as far as revealing anything. I kill my character off by, I think, chapter 8.
Okay. I'm going to have to go back and reread it now. So.
Okay, well, you have so many.
It is a great book.
So many great titles, and every single one a thriller. Rough Riders, Johnny Porno, Shakedown, Cheapskates, Eddie's World, Jimmy Bench Press, Charlie Opera. And is this other one pronounced, is it Mafia or Mafia?
Oh, it's Mafia, but it's the Russian like Mafia, but it's Mafia. The way the Russians, the red fellas spell it that way. Yeah.
And don't forget Dogfella, how an abandoned dog named Bruno turned a mobster's life around. And that book is about James Giuliani?
Yes. It's a true story. It's the guy who literally was on his skids. The guy did 2 years in the joint, and he turned it all around. Yeah.
Wow.
And he actually does that 24/7, takes care of dogs, rescues them, you know, houses them. So that's true.
Well, that'll endear him to all of my audience for sure. No matter what he's done before, he's redeemed. And same for you. We are so, whatever it was you've done, we are so grateful that you write and that you publish, that you send this out, that you went to the MFA program at the Southern New Hampshire and met our friend Pete Sherry Meeks.
The Georgia Peach.
I'm so glad I met Charlie, too. He's a great guy and an excellent writer. I mean, an excellent writer.
And so thank you so much for sharing your work with us, Charlie.
So thank you for the opportunity, Jennifer. I really appreciate it.
Hey,
and
thank you.
I'll send you recommendations too. You know, a lot of good writers would love to be there, and musicians. I know quite a few good musicians.
Yes, do please do. We would like that very, very much. I hope that you will come back to Madame Perry's Salon. I know it looks a little bit like the inside of a genie's bottle, but I mean, you know, you've been in probably better and worse places, so you know.
Absolutely.
And so please come back again, Charlie.
Okay, listen.
Don't Don't forget Sherry Meek's
book,
Finding Tamara.
Oh, I'm going to definitely, definitely. I'll be reviewing it on my blog.
And
for sure.
And remember, we're gonna be touring up in your neck of the woods eventually, Charlie. So send the people out.
Always welcome. Always welcome. My wife will cook for you. She'll make a meal that'll gain 5 pounds each. No problem.
Oh, listen, I can't
wait.
Charlie, I got Sicilian in my background, so you know I'm looking forward to this.
Okay. Oh, that's well. There you go. That's the only real Italian, by the way.
All right. So, folks, thank you so much for being here at Madam Perry's Salon. I've got all the links here for Charlie Stella, Sherry Meeks, and always leave a comment. Remember, this is still available as a free download afterwards, and we'd love to have your comments. Buy Charlie Stella's books and buy Sherry Meeks' books. And remember, just keep your groove going.